I'd like to make this, I mean, continue the sort of the tutorial aspect of the first talk of this morning. And I'm going to talk about stochastic chemical kinetics, review some things that I think most of you already know, except that there are always a lot of holes and things that don't get sufficient emphasis, I think, sometimes, or some things we forget. And I just wanted to go over them and give a perspective of things. In chemical kinetics, the game is this. We have a system that consists of n chemical species, S sub 1, S sub n. Each of these is a different chemical species, a different kind of molecule. And these species interact with each other through M reaction channels, R sub 1 to Rm. For example, here's an n equals m equals 2 system. An S1 molecule bumps into an S2 molecule, and it makes two S1 molecules. In other words, the S1 catalyzes a conversion of an S2 to an S1. And then the reverse of that is the reaction R2. When I say reaction, I don't mean a reaction like two hydrogen molecules plus one oxygen molecule makes two water molecules. That's something that chemists can write down, but that's not an event. That's not an elementary reaction event that happens, because three molecules rarely come together and make two other molecules. It happens in sequences and stages. And I'm interested in reactions that are the most basic kind of reaction. For example, an H plus an OH bang together, and they would make a water molecule. We're going to assume that the system has a constant volume, omega, and it's at a constant temperature, T. We also assume, and this is very important, a very strong restriction, that the system is well stirred, or spatially homogeneous. How might that happen? Well, it happens, one way that it can happen is you can put a swivel stick in it and stir it. Another way that it can happen is that the system can be self-stirring. Reactions like this happen because molecules bump into each other. But every time an S1 molecule and an S2 molecule bump into each other, they don't automatically go to this reaction. Usually they just bounce off. And these elastic collisions, these non-reactive collisions, stir the system up. And if between every reactive collision there are a lot of non-reactive collisions, the system is self-stirring, and this spatial homogeneity will obtain. We're going to let capital X sub I of T be the number of SI molecules in the system at time T. Not the concentration, but the number of molecules. And we're going to aggregate these in quantities into a vector X of T, call it the state of the system at time T. And the problem of chemical kinetics is, if we know the state of the system is X naught at some initial time T naught, what's the system at some later time T greater than T naught? The traditional approach to this problem asserts that X of T evolves in time according to a set of coupled first order ordinary differential equations of the form like this. One equation for each species, where F sub I is a function, usually it's nonlinear, but it's determined by the forms of the M reaction channels. How many of you know where this comes from? I got to thinking, where was it that these are called the reaction rate equations, by the way. And I was thinking to myself, where did I learn the reaction rate equation? Why do I believe this is true? And I had to regress all the way back to my freshman year in chemistry. It was a long time ago. Professor Fahrenheit was my teacher. It was an old Professor Bunsen. I don't care. Some old chemist, because I'm an old guy. I go into this trance, sort of like a psychological regression, and I can hear him say to me and to everybody else, "This is the law of mass action." And I say, "Okay." And that's it. Now, is there some better reason for believing this is true than what might be called common sense? I mean, I guess this has sort of degenerated, and this is the common sense way you're going to do things. I mean, Newton's equations are differential equations, and it describes all of classical mechanics, and chemical reactions can more or less be described by classical mechanics, so it's got to be something like this, right? Common sense. You remember what Einstein said about common sense? Common sense is a set of prejudices acquired at an early age. So I think that somewhat belongs there. Having said all that, these things really work well. No question about it. We know lots of systems where this really works well. And I want to return to that a little bit later. But I should say that usually these equations are written in terms of the concentrations, which are the populations divided by the total volume of the system. But that's a scaling that's not important for us. What it implies is that what the reaction rate equations apply is that x of t is a continuous deterministic process. That's the way it is with differential equations. But in fact, x of t is not continuous. It's discrete. Molecules, if you remember, come in whole numbers, and molecular populations change only by integer amounts. Moreover, x of t is not deterministic. It's stochastic. Why is this? It would be deterministic only if we were to define the system state as not just the numbers of molecules of each species, but in addition, the positions and the velocities of all the molecules, and assume Newtonian mechanics. Under those conditions, we could regard the system as being deterministic. But you know, not quite. Because even then, the extreme sensitivity to initial conditions renders the system effectively stochastic. It's like a tossed coin. A coin is a classical object. You flip it into the air, it obeys classical mechanics, and you can say this is a completely deterministic system. We never think of it that way. We think the outcome of a tossed coin is random. And why is that? Because in order to make it effectively or practically deterministic, we would have to have exquisite control on the initial conditions. And we just don't have that. Change the initial condition just slightly, and the thing diverges. So we're dealing with a stochastic system here. Chemical reactions occur as discrete events as a result of molecular collisions that we cannot precisely predict. And at best, we can predict only the probability that a certain reaction will occur. And let's talk about that. Consider this reaction here. Suppose reaction Rj is S1 plus S2 goes to something. How should we think about that physically? Well, imagine in the system here taking a molecule of species 1 and a molecule of species 2. We're going to assume they're spherical. That shows I'm a physicist. A physicist thinks that all molecules are balls. And I know they're not, but I'm not really happy with the fact that they're not. And I'd do it differently, frankly. I would make them all balls. But anyway, play like they're balls like that, and just pick a pair at random, molecule 1 and molecule 2. Stand on molecule 2 and look at molecule 1. It's moving with a certain velocity. If you imagine about molecule 1 a circle or a surface, a sphere, inscribed about the center whose radius is the sum of the two radii of the molecules, then I think you can see that if the center of molecule 2 happens to lie on the surface of that sphere, that imaginary sphere, the molecules are going to collide. Now, in a time delta t, this sphere, because molecule 1 is moving relative to molecule 2, sweeps out a collision volume in the form of a cylinder. The length of the cylinder is the velocity, the relative velocity times delta t, the time of interest. And the cross-sectional area is just pi r12 squared. This is a collision volume in the sense that if it happens to be the case that the center of 2 lies inside that collision volume right now, then in the next delta t, those two molecules are going to collide. So the question is, does the center of 2 lie inside that volume? We don't know. Because remember, these were molecules that we picked at random. We don't know where they are. All we know is that V12 is the velocity, the relative velocity is Maxwellian. We know that is to the case, that's the case, but otherwise we have no idea where in the volume these molecules are. So the best we can say is this: if the system is well stirred, then the probability that the center of 2 will lie inside that volume is the ratio of that volume to the total system volume. That's a number between 0 and 1. And if delta t is small, I mean how small as we like, as close to 0 as we like, That is the probability that these two molecules will actually collide, not necessarily react, just collide in the next delta T. So this ratio right here is the probability that a randomly chosen S1, S2 pair will collide in the next delta T. But now colliding is not reacting. If we want to know the probability that they will react, we have to multiply that collision probability by the probability that a colliding pair will actually react. And how are you going to calculate that? Well, that depends on what the mechanism is. But consider this simple mechanism. Suppose it's the case that a colliding 1-2 pair will react if they hit together sufficiently hard. Question?
Yeah, should the axis of the displacement be along the axis of the center of the molecule?
The axis of the displacement, we don't know where they are.
We're in the reference frame of molecule 2.
We're in the reference frame of an arbitrary molecule 2 looking at an arbitrary molecule 1. And all we know, all we can really say is what the relative velocity is in magnitude. But we have no idea of direction. We have no idea of space. The question you're asking, though, goes to the calculation of this conditional reaction probability. The probability that a pair of colliding molecules will actually undergo this reaction RJ. And suppose it's the case that the reaction will take place if the collisional energy is greater than some value E sub J. Now, by collisional energy, we mean the energy associated with the component of the relative velocity normal to the line of centers at contact. In other words, we're not interested in glancing collisions. I mean, they could be coming real fast, but just brush each other. That's probably not going to happen. You want the component of the relative velocity normal to the line of centers at contact to have an energy associated with it that's greater than some value E sub J. Well, you can prove an interesting thing. If that's the condition for the reaction to occur, that the collisional kinetic energy has to exceed E sub J, you can prove that if the velocities of the molecules are Maxwell-Boltzmann distributed, then the probability that that will happen is the exponential, the minus EJ over Boltzmann constant times the temperature. You recognize that as the Arrhenius factor. But here, there's a nice physical interpretation of it. The Arrhenius factor, that exponential, is the probability that a colliding pair will do so energetically with an energy greater than the reaction energy required for this particular reaction to occur. And of course, you'll notice that right here I put a bar over the V12. We're talking about an average pair, and that V12 means we're going to average this over the Maxwell-Boltzmann. That gives you a factor something like the square root of kT over the reduced mass of the particles, with some other factors thrown in, 8 pi kT, something like that. Okay, this then is a probability that a randomly chosen S1, S2 pair will react according to RJ in the next dt. But now I want to know, what's the probability that any of these reactions will occur? Well, you have to, it's that same factor for all possible pairs. So you have to add up these probabilities. And what you do, the adding up of those probabilities means just multiply by the number of distinct 1-2 molecular pairs. You multiply it by x1, x2. And what you get then is the total probability that some reaction RJ will occur somewhere inside the system in the next dt. Well, now you play some games. You take this dt out, put it here. Everything inside here we're going to call constant C sub J. It's the specific reaction probability rate constant. It's closely related to what chemists call the reaction rate constant. In fact, it differs only in the presence of this inverse omega right here. Otherwise, it's numerically the same as what chemists call the reaction rate constant, K sub J. We're going to call it C sub J, just emphasizes there's a difference. And what we'll keep the x1, x2 out. If you then lump the x1, x2 together, we're going to call this, what we say is the probability that a reaction is going to occur in the next dt is some function of the state, x, the current state x times dt. That's the thing we're after. And this function, whatever it is, it's going to be some constant times the number of distinct S1, S2 molecular pairs. We're going to call that the propensity function. This is the rationale for stochastic chemical kinetics. Obviously, I've made a lot of model assumptions, but the idea is that no matter what the shape of the molecules, what conditions going on, the probability that a reaction is going to occur in the next dt is going to be some function of state times dt. We're calling that function of state the propensity function.
I have a question.
Question.
What does
it feel like? If I can find it.
No.
Here. There.
Yeah. So basically, let's imagine that you're calculating this probability of reaction for any given pair. And I understand that even before you average over Maxwell distribution, you have this relative velocity you want to.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also have this exponential factor where this Ej, in my understanding, is just an energy in the reference frame of the center of mass.
Mm-hmm.
So then, I would imagine that in order to do averaging over Maxwell distribution, you would average both the product of V12 and the exponential factor.
The way you actually do
it. I don't understand why you put bar above the V12, where seemingly you would need to average over Maxwell distribution the whole quantity.
Okay. The answer is that in fact, the way you calculate this factor right here is you go back and you ask, what is the probability of the molecules colliding with a relative energy along the line of centers of contact greater than E sub J?
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to do the whole thing at once. We're not going to say colliding first and then doing it. But what you get, the answer to that function you get, you go through a lot of integrations and stuff like that. This is the answer that you get, where this V12 bar is the Maxwell-Boltzmann relative velocity. If you write it down, I think it's 8 pi kT over the reduced mass, something like that, of 1 and 2, times this factor here. But I know what this factor is already. I know that's the collision probability. So I've calculated this total reaction probability, and I can do another calculation that I just indicated to you what the collision probability is. That tells me what the physical significance of this factor here is. It's the probability that given a collision occurs, the collision will do so with an energy greater than Ej.
I guess what I didn't understand is the point. In your expression for Ej, you do the averaging across many pairs. You're going to have factors which will depend on this relative velocity.
Well, you understand Ej is a parameter. It's a complicated calculation, and I don't want to pretend that by looking at this you can see that result. To get that is a much more complicated calculation than to get this result here. When you do the whole thing, this is what you get. Okay. So that brings us then to, instead of chemical kinetics, stochastic chemical kinetics. And the hypothesis is that each elemental reaction channel, Rj, is defined by two quantities. First, there's this propensity function, Aj of x. It's defined so that you multiply it by dt, you get the probability, given that the current state is x, that one Rj reaction event will occur in the next dt. And dt has to be an infinitesimal. If dt is a finite infinitesimal, this probability would be greater than 1, and that's not right. That's no good for a probability. In fact, the derivation goes bad because in adding those probabilities up, I had to assume that these were mutually exclusive events. In other words, that no more than one reaction could occur in time delta t, or time dt. And that's only true if dt is vanishingly small. So the fact that dt is an infinitesimal is important to the derivation here and the definition of the propensity function. In addition to the propensity function, there's a state change vector, nu sub j. Nu sub I is components, nu sub ij, are the change in the Si population caused by one Rj event. Basically, nu sub ij is the stoichiometric matrix. But I'm looking at it here as a vector in I space, in the population space. One RJ reaction causes the state to change by this vector nu sub j. For example, the reaction we had before, the propensity function has the form of some constant C1 times X1, X2, because those are the reacting species. And the state change vector is +1 because the reaction creates an S1. Then the next component is -1 because it destroys an S2. The reverse reaction has a state change vector, it's the negative of the first one. The propensity function is a little bit different here. Remember, we want the total number of distinct combinations of molecules that will react accordingly. And this time, the number of distinct pairs is x1 times x1 minus 1 over 2. If you had just x1 squared here, it would be possible for one S1 molecule to go that way, and that can't happen. This prevents that from happening. The implication of all this is now that the vector x of t is a jump Markov process. A continuous time, discrete state, past forgetting, which is what Markov means, stochastic process.
Why is it Markov?
We'll show you that in a minute. It's Markov. We'll get that in a minute. Markov means that what happens next depends only on where you are now and is independent of how you got there. There's no memory beyond the value of the present state. If I tell you what the present state is, that certainly implies some memory. But beyond that, nothing that I can tell you about how it got to the present state will help you predict what's going to happen in the future. That's what Markov means. Past forgetting or memoryless.
Why is that implied in the formulation?
It's implied because when I wrote down this propensity function, in a way, I didn't look back in the past to say what has just happened before this reaction. And it's also implied in the next slide where we're going to derive the master equation.
Is it fair to say in a certain sense that by assuming that you always are in the Wahlstrom limit, that gives you a Markov?
Yeah.
Because you eliminate all other possible dynamical variables that we keep track of in the stream.
Good answer. Now, there are two approaches to stochastic chemical kinetics, and they're sort of complementary. There's an analytical approach and a simulation approach. They're logically equivalent. They both follow rigorously from the same stochastic premise, which is basically the definition of the propensity function. And they are exact if the system is well stirred or self-stirring. The analytical approach focuses on the probability density function of this population vector X, namely, this quantity here, the probability that the system will be in state little x at time t, given that it was in state little x naught at some initial time t naught. Now you can prove that p obeys this time evolution equation. And the usual way of looking at this is, yeah, well, okay, this is sort of a flow of probability into p, and this is a flow of probability out of p, and so, yeah, that's the way it goes. Okay, this flow, this probability flow, is what I call the hydrodynamic derivation of this result. But it's for plumbers. We're better than plumbers. Here's the way you really derive the master equation. You use the theory, you use the laws of probability, the addition law and the multiplication law. And for what we're going to do, the strategy here is this is a one-slide proof. We're going to write the probability that x at t plus, that the system at state t plus dt is little x. We're going to write that probability as the sum of the probabilities of all the mutually exclusive paths leading to this state at time t plus dt via possible states at the earlier time t. And here's how that goes. Okay, we start at state x naught t naught, and we want to know what the probability is of being at state x at time t plus dt. Well, one way we can get there is to start at state x naught t naught, start at state x naught at time t naught, and already be at state x at time t, and then nothing happens in the next dt. What's the probability that nothing happens in the next dt? Well, remember, aj of x dt is the probability that reaction j fires at time t. If I sum those over all the reaction channels, that's the probability that some reaction channel is going to fire in the next dt. If I subtract that from 1, I will get the probability that no reaction channel fires in the next DT. Multiplying that by that, that's the probability for this path. We start, we reach state X at time T, and then nothing happens in the next DT. Or we could be one RJ reaction removed from state X at time T, and then in that state, our reaction J fires, and that's this probability. And we sum that over all the reaction channels. This is the sum of the probabilities of all the ways of getting there. Here's where the Markov condition comes in. When we write, for example, this thing here, this is the probability we started at state X naught and T naught, and we got to state X minus nu J at time T. This is the subsequent probability that reaction channel RJ fires in the next DT, but it doesn't depend on the fact that we were in X naught at time T naught. If it were non-Markovian, this would depend on X naught, T naught as well. And you can see that non-Markov processes are messy, messy things. Stay away from them if you can. I mean, it's like practice safe stochastic process theory. Stay away from non-Markov processes. Okay, we have this result. You just subtract P of XT from both sides. You divide through by DT, let DT go to zero, and you get the chemical master equation. And I should note that we invoke the addition law here. It relies on the fact that DT is so small that no more than one reaction event will ever occur in DT. And that's just fine because we let DT go to zero and that condition is automatically satisfied. Well, what did I do? Okay. Oh, I think I'm going the wrong way. Yeah, okay, back to the chemical master equation. This is what it looks like. It's called the chemical master equation. In principle, it completely determines this function P, and hence the vector X of T. In practice, it's impossible to solve for all but the simplest of systems. Even if X is one-dimensional, this equation amounts to as many differential equations, coupled differential equations, as you have possible populations. And when you have lots of things, it's just very hard to solve. So we need to do something different, and we turn then to a simulation approach. The simulation approach does not use this function P that we just wrote down. It focuses on, it makes use of a different function, little p of tau j at x at time t. And we define that function as follows. When you multiply it by d tau, it's a function of tau and j, it's the probability, given that you're in state X at time T, that the next reaction in the system is going to be, it will occur in the infinitesimal time interval between T plus tau and T plus tau plus D tau, and will be an RJ reaction. In simpler terms, tau is the time to the next reaction in the system, and J is the index of that reaction. And this function is the probability density function, the jointly of those two random variables. You can prove that this function is given by this expression right here. Aj of x times e to the minus a naught of x tau, where a naught is the sum of all the propensity functions. How do you do that? Well, again, you use probability theory. If p naught of tau xt is the probability that no reactions will occur in the time interval t to t plus tau, then you can write this probability as the probability that nothing happens in a time tau, and then an RJ reaction happens in the next d tau. So you cancel the d taus, and this then is the formula for p, this joint density function. All we have to do is calculate p naught. Well, that's easy. P naught, the probability that nothing happens in time tau, has to satisfy this equation. The probability that nothing happens in time t to in the next t plus d tau is the probability that nothing happens in time tau times the probability that nothing happens in the next d tau, the same thing we wrote down a minute ago. That gives this differential equation right here. It's a simple ODE. Its solution for this obvious initial condition is this, and that proves the next reaction density function. So the simulation approach, what does this result mean? This implies that the time tau to the next reaction event A naught is the sum of the propensity functions. So this implies that the time tau to the next reaction event is an exponentially distributed random variable with mean 1 over A naught x. And it implies that the channel index, j, of that reaction is a random variable, an integer random variable, with probability pj over a naught of x. I haven't proved that, but you can show that disjoint density function implies this statement. Okay? And it turns out that it's easy on a computer using to generate random samples of tau and j according to this function. And I don't want to belabor how that's done, but the resulting stochastic simulation algorithm is this. This is an explicit, exact procedure for constructing a numerical realization of the stochastic process x of t. There are a number of ways of doing this. A simple one, the direct version, is this. Four steps. First step, with the system in the state x at time t, compute a naught of x, the sum of all the propensity functions. Next thing you do is you draw two unit interval uniform random numbers, R1 and R2. And you're going to use those to compute the time tau to the next reaction and the index j of the next reaction. And it's easy to do. Tau is given by this formula. Use R1 to construct tau, and you use R2 to construct j. J is the smallest interval that integer that satisfies this inequality. You get tau and j this way, and then you affect the next reaction. You replace t by t plus tau, and you replace x by x plus nu j. You record that state if you want, and you return to step one, or else in the simulation. Real simple. The stochastic simulation algorithm numerically simulates the time evolution of a well-stirred chemically reacting system in a way that accurately reproduces all effects of the naturally occurring randomness. Notice that in this algorithm, it never approximates a dt, an infinitesimal, by a delta t. That tau we get, the time to the next reaction, is something that comes out. It's not an approximation. It's exact. It's a sample of this exponential random variable, which we proved had to be the case. It's procedurally simple, even for systems whose chemical master equation is intractable. It's been improved on to be faster and more efficient in what I thought at the time and still think was a blindingly brilliant piece of work by Gibson and Brook. Mike Gibson, who was a graduate student at Caltech, he redesigned this algorithm in a way that effectively produces things according to that next reaction density function. But he only needs asymptotically one random number per event. He has a clever way of reusing random numbers, which in most cases is a prescription for disaster. But he did it correctly. I didn't think it was possible, but he did it. And it's a nice piece of work. It makes the code more efficient, more complicated. But part of that is because he has data structures that mean you don't have to do so many recalculations, as I was indicating. Nevertheless, with all the speed up this did, and this is the algorithm of choice, the Gibson-Brook algorithm is the algorithm of choice for large systems, especially for large systems whose stoichiometric matrix is sparse, and most of the time that's the case. But with that speed up, this thing remains too slow for most practical problems. The reason it simulates every reaction event, one at a time. So it can take a very long time to execute if any reactant, not necessarily all reactants, but if at least one reactant is present in such large numbers, as is usually the case, it just steps along very slowly in time. They did switch to absolute time. No, you can look on it in another way. There's another method. I described the direct method. Another method you could use is the so-called what I call the first reaction method. And what you do is you generate a pseudo exponential for each one, and then take the lowest. Well, another way to derive the Gibson-Brook formula algorithm is to start from that approach. And you can get that result. So it doesn't violate anything. It's right.
When you say that this simulates a reaction system in a way that accurately removes all effects attached to retained randomness, could you specify what you mean there? Because the assumptions that you made in the stochastic process are certainly not exact in the sense of how chemical reactions actually occur in nature. There must be a statement about distributions in there somehow.
Well, let me put it this way. You're right. To the extent that there are that the system is not well stirred, this is not exact.
I mean specifically about the nature of the collision process.
The collision processes, I assume, were one model. But my contention is that if you take some other model, and maybe when the collision occurs, it's not that it has to hit so hard, but maybe it needs a certain orientation. Well, you just redo things. That changes the formula for the things that are in C sub J. But the main result of this is that there is a C sub J, and you multiply it by the number of reacting pairs, and you multiply that by dt, and that's the probability the reaction will occur in the next dt. That, I think, is a fairly solid assumption, up to a point.
So, but do you mean that you actually reproduce the distributions, PDFs, of naturally occurring events?
So if I
take a law of mass action, it's going to accurately reproduce what's going on in the well-stirred system case, as far as the mean is concerned.
Sometimes it doesn't even do that.
Well, in the well-stirred limit, if we take that.
In the well-stirred limit and the thermodynamic limit, which means infinitely large systems, for some systems, as long as it's not bimodal, it will work.
Yeah. So that's what I mean. So are you claiming that actually further properties of distribution are simulated accurately by
this? Yeah, I'm saying that if you have a well, I mean, first of all, the reaction rate equations also requires the system be well stirred. And secondly, it requires that you be in the so-called thermodynamic limit of infinitely large volume, infinitely large molecular populations. Okay. I'm saying that you can relax the large limit assumption, and the stochastic simulation algorithm still remains good. Whereas it will reflect whatever fluctuations would be expected for the particular population you've chosen.
I'd like to follow up on the first question, because it's something that I also don't understand. Your model is based on the assumption that you have this spherical things. Now, the only experiments that one could presumably do in practice would be things where molecules are very large, things like proteins, and things like
right.
that, which obviously don't look like this at all. So is there any experimental validation, whatever, anywhere in the literature, in history, of these kinds of things? I'm not being aggressive, I just really want to know, because I don't
know. No, I don't know. I have only done it for that simple case, but the same criticism.
It's not a criticism, it's a question, because
I don't either. I don't. This is the best I've done. I played around with some other things, flowing around. All I can say is that the assumptions for the stochastic simulation algorithm, the chemical master equation, are somewhat weaker than the assumptions for the reaction rate equation.
No, I understand.
But certainly there are still.
But one could think of doing experiments with large proteins, a very small number thereof,
Every time you do an experiment, you see Clifford kinetics, it's a validation of the idea.
No. But you run the experiment. Many times you collect statistics and you see whether the first and second moments, for instance, predicted by this, would match. I mean, that's the way to try to
validate,
right?
Well,
yeah, but the basic formula is what the probability for reaction rate occurs is the number of, it's x1, x2 times some number.
Yeah.
Right? Any time that you do something, you see first order kinetic validation of that overall model, there's a question of where did that CJ number come from? And, in the end, who knows? You measure.
No, but I guess I'm really confused because so much effort goes into all this, but if nobody has ever been able to test experimentally, I really don't know.
So basically, there are some experiments, so they're not formal, attempts to be validated, but there are some basic experiments on gene expression.
Okay.
It looks like it's working.
What, meaning that when one actually collects the statistics, it matches.
I could send you the PDF, you could compare it to this.
That's neat. Okay.
But I mean, there are real challenges in terms. They're not. The bounds on the experiments are not obviously as tight as the bounds on the models that are being used.
so there's the match isn't this type that you might want to use. But I guess anyway.
Another question? I can't answer that, you know.
The measured diffusion rate for a protein in bacteria is about 7.8 microns squared per second. So the second goes up to cell. That's the work of all of us, if you believe it. So on those time scales, on the time scales of gene expression, it's probably holding up the amount.
And the experiments that you referred to?
Alexander Gangerman.
That they were done for
thing or okay. If I could just make one further comment, I don't understand why people are saying that you can only test these models with large proteins.
Yeah,
I mean, these kinds of reaction models are tested all the time with single atoms and gas states.
Yeah, I see.
Principle is single. Think about earlier, inelastically cross sections.
And you get one gets perfect matches.
When it works, you get a perfect match. When it doesn't, you don't.
Thanks.
But, yes.
So have you looked at how well this works for gas-based chemistry, especially like inserted reactions?
No, I haven't.
Orientation is really important. Things have to line, like for an SN2 reaction, you have to have that. But I think that it might still work because the requirement of orientation could be captured in the energy term. So you're not
yes.
Have to
yeah, I've done that. That I mean, if you have a stereo effect, you know, in other words, there's the two things have to, so there's a solid angle on one molecule and a solid angle on the other, and they have to touch. Then the probability is, you know, what's the probability that this thing is being isotropic? Most of the time, will actually be lined up, and it's just sort of a solid angle ratio factor. So if you want, think of that model that I proposed as a simple suggestive model, and may it serve as an inspiration for people who want to go to more complicated models to try to get things, but my feeling is that you're always going to come out with the same basic structure, the answer to first order reaction kinetics, as Adeo said. Mm-hmm. Yes. To capture stochastic effects whenever those stochastic effects are important.
Right. So the question is the following. There were quite a lot of previous efforts to deal with that problem. For example, scaling some noise terms to your system of coordinate differential equations like Lange events.
Yes, I'm going to get to that, and I want to say that I don't like that proposal. I think it's very ad hoc to start with the differential equations whose derivations you're not sure of anyway, and then add some noise terms which you pull out of the air just to satisfy certain boundary conditions. This is the time-honored way, I grant you, the time-honored way of dealing with Langevin equations. We're going to do something better than that in this talk. I will get a Langevin equation. I will derive it, including both the drift term and the diffusion term, from this thing, these assumptions. So let me go on. The question is, why bother with all of this? For most practical chemical systems, the molecular populations are very large, and the phenomenological reaction rate equations, which looks like this when we're talking about molecular numbers rather than concentrations, This set of ordinary differential equations is very accurate and very fast. So what's the problem? Well, in small biochemical systems, like the inside of a living cell, it can happen that some critical reactant species are present in low numbers. Not necessarily all, but just maybe a few, maybe one or two key reactant ones. And that small number may couple with certain nonlinearities in the reaction chain so that the inherent stochasticity of the system suddenly becomes noticeable. In those cases, the deterministic reaction rate equation can be inaccurate and misleading. And for such systems, one possible way is drop back to the chemical master equation or the stochastic simulation algorithm. And since we usually can't solve the cannot solve the chemical master equation, that leaves us with this puppy here. And as I just told you, that's often hard to do. And in the rest of my talk, I want to address two questions. One, is there some way to speed up the SSA for larger systems, for non-small systems, systems that are medium-large or large or extra-large, even at the cost of some exactness? That's question one. And question two is somewhat more philosophical. How does it happen that this rigorous but computationally intractable chemical master equation, this guy here, segues for large systems to this heuristic but computationally very efficient reaction rate equation? And what I want to, the nice thing about it, these questions are related. One approach, an initial step to answering this question, turns out to give the answer to the second question, and that's what I want to show you in the rest of this talk. Start with question one. Is there some way to speed up the SSA for large systems? A context for doing that, maybe not the only way, but the context that seems reasonable to us at the moment is something called tau leaping. It's an approximate accelerated stochastic simulation procedure. It's not intended to replace the stochastic simulation algorithm when all the reactants are present in small populations. And under those circumstances, the SSA is pretty efficient as it is. It's meant to help the SSA in cases where at least one species is very large or moderately large. The idea is to advance the process by a pre-selected time tau, not one that we generate, but we kind of pull it out of the air in some way, a time tau which may encompass more than one reaction event. What else can we do? We've got to take a leap. We can't take a step to the next reaction. We've got to leap over some reactions. Now the size, though, it turns out, when you start thinking about this and the way we're going to implement it, the size of tau, the size of our time leap, is limited by a so-called leap condition. And the leap condition says that, of course, when you make a leap in time, you are going to drag along with you a change in the system state. And that system state is going to induce a change in the values of the propensity functions. And we have to, the leap condition says that the changes in the propensity function values during the leap, or made by the leap, must be in some sense small. That's what limits the size of the leap we can take. It's very similar to what you're doing if you're doing an Euler integration, a simple Euler integration. You can't take a step when the rate function changes by too much. If you take a very small step, then maybe you can do it. Okay, and it turns out that we're gonna win with this strategy. We're gonna get some accelerated simulation whenever it's possible to satisfy this leap condition, yet have the leap encompass many reaction events. The key ideas underlying tau leaping are this. First, a definition. The Poisson random variable P with parameters A and tau, where A and tau are positive constants. That Poisson random variable can be defined as the number of events that will occur in a time tau, which may be very large, given that the probability for a single event to occur in any infinitesimal dt is A dt. This is the definition, a possible definition of the Poisson random variable. Well, that's very relevant to what we're trying to do. Because if we're in state X at time t, and if tau is such that the propensity functions of each reaction constant, of each reaction channel, is constant in the next tau, then we can use this. The number of RJ reactions that will occur in that next tau is approximately this Poisson random variable. And it works because there numerical procedures actually exist for generating sample values of the Poisson random variable. And secondly, we've developed a way to estimate in advance the largest tau that is in some way consistent with the leap condition. I'm not going to go through the method of choosing tau to make sure it satisfies the leap condition. It's here in two slides, but we're running a little bit late. Tau, it turns out, is the minimum of this function here. What we're going to try to do is we're going to try to pick tau so that the change in each propensity function in time tau, starting in state x, so that actually, now that's a random variable. We want the mean and the standard deviation of that random variable both to be less than the total propensity function, the sum of all the propensity functions, times some accuracy control parameter epsilon, which is usually much less than 1. And it turns out by making some assumptions, you can show that by picking tau to be the minimum over j of these two quantities, where those two quantities are defined in a way that looks complicated but actually can be pre-computed before the calculation, you can estimate in advance what's the largest tau I can take for a given epsilon. And the result is this tau leap simulation algorithm. Again, it's four steps. First step, you're in state x at time t, you want to move ahead. You choose a time tau so that the expected change in every propensity function in the next tau is bounded by epsilon times a naught of x, where epsilon is something you're just going to have to choose, maybe 0.03. Having chosen tau that way, all right, you generate the number k sub j, of the number of firings, k sub j, of channel r sub j in the next tau. K sub j is going to be this Poisson random variable with the propensity function aj of x and tau. Then you leap. You replace t by t plus tau, and you replace x by x plus the number of times reaction channel j fires times the state change per firing. You record x, you return to state one, or else you end the simulation. That's tau leaping. And I apologize for this sudden display of color in my slides. Real scientists, of course, don't use color. Science is all black and white. This is not the tau leaping. I'm going to show you an exact SSA simulation, and I'm going to show you the tau leap simulation of the same reaction. Here's the reaction. I've got a monomer, S1, which can do one of two things. The monomer can either just decay and go away, become inactive. That's the first reaction. The second reaction channel is that a monomer plus a monomer can make a dimer. But that dimer can turn around and decay, is an unstable dimer. S2 is an unstable dimer. It can decay back to its monomer form, its two monomers. Or, every once in a while, the dimer, the unstable dimer, can be converted into a stable dimer. Okay, I choose these reaction rates. I start with 100,000 X1 monomers, and the number of stable and unstable dimers is 0, and I let it roll using the stochastic simulation algorithm. I'm using large population levels because, remember, we're trying to do a stochastic simulation when the populations are large. If the populations are small, we don't need to do leaping. We can do the SSA. Well, starting at 100,000, you see the rate up here is 50,000, and the first thing that happens is that the S1 population comes screaming down to 5,000 as this reaction, the second reaction, takes place. The monomers start converting to dimers real, real fast. And at this point right here, and the monomers are coming down and the unstable dimers are going up, which are green. At this time right here, we kind of suddenly reach a quasi-equilibrium between the monomers and the unstable dimers. And then, as the unstable dimers convert to X3 and the monomers go to 0, everything kind of, the monomer population goes down, the unstable dimer population goes down, and the stable dimer population rises. In this run, I've plotted a dot after every 500 steps, or every 500 reactions. In other words, I did 500 reactions using the SSA, and then I plotted the state. Simple to do it that way. So every dot here is what happens after 500 reactions. And you can see reactions begin, as the populations get small, they get less and less frequent. The last reaction occurred out here at time 48. The final X3 value was this. The total number of steps, the total number of reactions in this were 524,000, over 500,000 reactions occurred. Question?
How do you end up with more than half as many dimers as you had monomers to begin with?
Had 100,000 I didn't. We started with 100,000.
Oh, I think so.
It's up here. It started way up there. Okay. The key points to note here are 524,000 reactions, 524,000 steps. Here's the same run using tau leaping, which for reasons you'll understand, I'm calling explicit tau leaping. You'll find when Linda talks, you'll understand why. I chose an epsilon value of 0.03, same initial conditions. The point is that how many, and here I've plotted every dot represents one leap, one reaction. 592 leaps total. And if I go backwards and forwards, not bad. There's still a little fuzziness down here and up here. I mean, you see that in this region right here, it just looks a little scudsy. We think that's stiffness, don't we?
I'm not sure if that's stiffness or not, but yeah.
We think.
Maybe a mild instability.
Okay. It certainly induces, but it's those fluctuations that cause the propensity functions to move around. And that's another problem. The initial paper that published tau leaping had a slightly different, well, not a slightly different, a very different scheme for assessing how far ahead in time we should go. In other words, how to pick tau. It wasn't as stable as this. This is an improvement over the original tau leaping paper, and if any of you are interested, we can talk about that. But, okay, that's tau leaping. The bottom line, well, this doesn't have all the bottom lines. Tau leaping usually speeds things up, but first of all, you have to be careful. It's not automatic. The tau leap condition usually requires us to use a smaller tau than we would like. We'd like to stretch out a little bit more. Selecting tau consistent with a leap condition entails some computational overhead, although it's not all that much. In any case, generating Poisson random numbers is more time consuming than generating the exponential random numbers that we need for the SSA. There are problems, we think, with stiffness. There can be problems with stiffness caused by multiple time scales. Tau leaping itself does not solve the problem of multiple time scales. But we think it's a context. I think it's the right context in which the multiple time scale problem can be solved. But we have to do more. But tau leaping by itself won't solve that. We have to do something else. It's a decent first start, but it needs improving. Okay, now let me turn finally to the second question. How does the chemical master equation and the stochastic simulation algorithm, in other words, stochastic chemical kinetics, how does it segue to the reaction rate equation for so-called large systems? Here's how that happens. We saw in tau leaping that if we're in state little x at time t, and if tau is macroscopically infinitesimal, what do I mean by that? Well, it's small in that none of the propensity functions changes noticeably during the next tau. If that's true, then to a very good approximation, the system update, the state at time t plus tau is going to be the state at time t plus this sum over these Poisson random variables, the number of times reaction channel RJ fires, times the state change vector, nu sub j. These p sub j's here are statistically independent Poisson random variables. We proved this a minute ago. Now suppose it also happens that during this time tau, every reaction channel RJ fires many more times than once. And this is actually what happens if all the reactant populations are very large. Well, in that case, then the mean number of that Poisson, which turns out to be the product AJ times tau, is going to be much greater than 1. Now, this is a Poisson random variable with mean and variance AJ times tau. It turns out that for the generic Poisson random variable, if the mean and variance are both large compared to 1, then you can approximate a Poisson random variable by a normal random variable. Normal random variables are much nicer than Poisson random variables for lots of reasons. But when we make that approximation here, we just substitute in the normal random variable with mean AJ tau and variance AJ tau into that previous formula where before we had a Poisson. Now you can play some games. You can always take a normal random variable, pull out its mean as a constant, and pull out its variance with a square root, making it the standard deviation, and being left with a normal random variable with mean 0 and variance 1. And then you resum, collect terms, resum this. Remember that little x is the state at times t. You wind up with this update formula. The state at times t plus tau is the state at time t plus this term here, the sum over j of nu j, aj of the state t state of the time t state x times tau. You see, so far, that's the reaction rate equation. Plus, and that comes from this term here, plus the stuff that comes from this term. The nu sub j times the square root of the propensity function times the normal random variable with mean 0 and variance 1 times the square root of tau.
Doesn't your state now become negative?
Say again?
It's a normal distributed random variable.
That's right. It could become negative. It could become negative. This is an approximation. In fact, the normal random variable very seldom goes out beyond three standard deviations. And these approximations up here, which means that the mean and the variance, the mean in particular, is very large, means that you're away from the origin and the negativity almost never comes in. It nevertheless is an approximation. Let's be very clear about this. This is an approximation. The reason it's an approximation also is that the normal random variable is not an integer random variable. We are now in the, x is now a continuous variable. So it's definitely an approximation. Nonetheless, we get this formula here. We just proved the following theorem. Let me change tau now to d bar t, a macroscopic infinitesimal. During d bar t, it's defined in this way. No propensity function changes its value significantly. In that sense, it's an infinitesimal. But it's macroscopic in the sense that during d bar t, every reaction channel fires many more times than once. Under those conditions, we can approximate the t to t plus d tau update by this, and this is a Langevin equation. This is the time evolution equation for what's called a continuous Markov process. We had been working with a discrete or jump Markov process. Now we're in the realm of continuous Markov process theory. We've approximated the jump Markov process described by a master equation with the continuous Markov process described by this chemical Langevin equation. For those of you who know things about stochastic differential equations, you can take the x of t to the other side, divide through by d bar t, and come up with this, where gamma of t is Gaussian white, is something called Gaussian white noise. It satisfies this correlation condition where this is the Dirac delta function and that's the Kronecker delta function. If you don't understand that, don't worry about it. There's nothing in this equation that you can't get out of this equation with less hazard. And what I mean by that is this shows that this is an equation for the derivative of x of t. Now, it's a fact that a continuous Markov process, x of t, is an example of a mathematical function that is everywhere continuous. That's why we call it continuous. But it's nowhere differentiable. Well, if it's nowhere differentiable, why are we writing down an equation for the derivative? The reason is because Gaussian white noise is something that's very, very hokey. And the only reason we do this is because scientists and engineers are so accustomed to thinking everything can be described by a differential equation that we're going to go ahead and take this, even though it doesn't exist. We'll pretend that it exists, and we get this. But it's... pardon?
Sorry, is there a delay, elaborate way to justify why this procedure is accurate?
Why this procedure is accurate?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, look at this. When you divide this by dt,
no.
You get...
What I said is that even though it might seem that it's a problem that derivative is ill-defined, mathematicians have dealt with that problem with respect to this as t is for n years.
Well, in fact, the way they deal with it is they don't write it like this very often. They usually write it like this, or they call this d... They bring the dt inside this normal random variable and call the result dw, but they leave it written out like that. They never divide by dt. Mathematicians really don't divide by dt. They talk about the d of a Wiener process. But
the correct mathematics is just really basic. You do the thing on top of nothing.
Yeah. Yeah.
The thing at the bottom, you just have, we have to remember the thing at the bottom is a shorthand for what's up top.
That's right. This is a shorthand for this.
This is a shorthand for what's up there. The thing at the bottom doesn't actually mean anything.
I agree with that completely. Okay.
And that's how that would think about thing at the top, is that the bottom thing is a shorthand.
Now, in the theory of Markov processes, every Langevin equation implies a Fokker-Planck equation. The Langevin equation shows, for a continuous Markov process, the Langevin equation shows how x of t changes. The Fokker-Planck equation addresses the changes in the corresponding density function p. And for this particular Langevin equation, which we're calling the chemical Langevin equation, you can show that this is the corresponding Fokker-Planck equation. Perfectly well defined. The point I want to make here is that in this Langevin equation, though, this is the noise term. And the noise term is not something we have tacked on gratuitously at the end, just to make this first part stochastic. It's grown, both the noise term, this term, and this drift term, the diffusion term and the drift term, have been sort of organically derived from the same premises that we started out with, from the fact that approximately this is a Poisson random variable. And the reason you have a root dt here and a dt here is because a Poisson random variable is a variable whose mean and variance are equal, which means that the standard deviation is the square root of the mean. There's the result of the square root. I think it's pretty neat. Now, we're just about there. Now we're going to consider the thermodynamic limit. How do you define the thermodynamic limit? In chemistry, here's the definition, the chemical definition of the thermodynamic limit. All the population, the reactant populations, go to infinity. And the volume goes infinity in such a way that the densities stay constant, approach a constant value. Now you can prove that in this limit, all propensity functions of all reactions grow linearly with the system size. And you're saying, how can that be? For example, for a bimolecular reaction, the propensity function is something times two molecular populations. It looks like that ought to grow quadratically with the system size. But remember, in the constant Cj that multiplied it, it has the volume on the bottom that kills one of the other two. All propensity functions grow linearly with the system size. So what happens in the chemical Langevin equation in the thermodynamic limit? Well, these three terms here grow linearly with the system size, and this term is growing square root, as the square root of the system size. So this term eventually becomes negligibly small. It drops off. We're left with this. This is the reaction rate equation. This is how I claim the reaction rate equation really arises. Professor Fahrenheit didn't know. And he never will. It's a good thing I didn't get my degree under him, right? All right. Finally, let me give you a big overview. We have now a hierarchy of schemes for modeling chemical kinetics, or at least an overview. At the most basic, most accurate level, we have molecular dynamics. Molecular dynamics tracks the position and velocity of every molecule. It simulates every collision, reactive as well as non-reactive. It shows changes in species populations and species concentrations. It's essentially exact, but it's really, really slow. Suppose it's possible that the function of the non-reactive collisions, that they occur so frequently that all they do is stir the molecules up. In that case, the system is well stirred, the system is spatially homogeneous, and we can use the stochastic simulation algorithm, which is the same as the master equation. The stochastic simulation algorithm now is going to simulate only the reactive collisions. It's going to ignore the many non-reactive collisions, and so that's a big boost in efficiency. But we can only do this if this first condition is true, if the system is self-stirring. This stochastic simulation algorithm tracks only the species populations. It doesn't tell you anything about spatial concentrations. That they're assumed to be uniform. It's exactly equivalent to the master equation, and because it only looks at reactive collisions, it's much faster than molecular dynamics. The next step up is tau leaping. Tau leaping is an approximation to the stochastic simulation algorithm. It advances time by a pre-selected tau, chosen in such a way that no propensity function changes its value very much in the next tau, but more than one reaction event may occur. In this case, the number of firings of each channel Rj in time tau is approximated by a Poisson random variable with mean and variance Aj tau. It's faster than the stochastic simulation whenever many reactions occur in tau. If we can arrange it so that many reactions occur in this state, then we're going to get an increase in efficiency. But it's an approximation. Then we go to the chemical Langevin equation. It's a special case of tau leaping. It applies whenever the mean of all these Poisson random variables is much greater than 1. In that case, the number of Rj firings in tau can be approximated as a normal random variable with mean and variance Aj tau, same mean and variance as this, except instead of Poisson, it's normal. This is essentially a stochastic differential equation that approximates the jump Markov process of the chemical master equation and the stochastic simulation algorithm by a continuous Markov process, and it's faster than ordinary tau leaping for 2 reasons. It's faster because we're going to be leaping over lots of reactions of every channel, and secondly, normal random variables are a lot easier to generate than Poisson random variables. And finally, if we go to the thermodynamic limit of very large systems, the random diffusion term in the chemical Langevin equation becomes negligibly small compared to the deterministic drift term. That Langevin equation reduces from a stochastic differential equation to an ordinary differential equation. It therefore defines a continuous deterministic process. It's computationally the fastest. The challenge, of course, which Linda and I are working on, is to build a seamless, easy-to-use software package that automatically selects the optimal and appropriate method to advance the state in time and that executes that method correctly and efficiently. And having said all this, and having said what probably sounds like a lot of bad things about the reaction rate equation, you're probably wondering, when Linda and I get together, do we fight? Do we sneer at each other? And I sneer at her ordinary differential equations, and she sneers at me. The answer is no. We've never done that. We've had a few differences of opinion, not many, but they've never been over the primality of the SDE of the reaction rate equation versus the SSA. What we're trying to do is look in between there and find when it's possible to be as close as we can to the reaction rate equation, which is computationally efficient, yet retain some of the stochasticity or whatever is necessary from the SSA. And that's our mission, and that's the thing that we're moving on. And now Linda is going to tell you some of the things we've been doing, which is an advance on explicit tau leaping. Other questions? Oh. Okay. I don't want to do that, sorry.
There are many systems that are actually locally well set, but not global. And the only exception to this that is needed in order to simulate these, I'm thinking about things like the Russo double instinct or something.
Uh-huh.
It's certainly locally well set, but it's not globally well set. The only thing that you need to do is maybe put it on a lattice and have it spatially interact. Have a spatially interactive system.
Well,
so I think exactly the same principles could work for the systems that are locally well set.
That form the patterns, you mean?
Yes.
Yes, okay. And it's also possible to put a magnetic stir in a beaker of the Belousov-Jabotinsky reaction and watch the thing pulse with a period of about 20 seconds.
Exactly the same principles are going to work. Local concentrations are going to change.
What you have to do is to chop the volume up. And in principle, this is possible. In practice, it's very difficult because for every volume, you now have to consider, in addition to the reactions that go on separately in the two volumes, all the diffusive transfer that takes place.
Yes.
It's hard to do, but in principle, yes, you're right. I agree with you. Another question? Yes.
So enzymes apparently aren't memoryless. So you said one of the first assumptions is that X or T is memory of the same jump one muscle. So you can have confirmation change in an enzyme.
Oh, then
you
call them different species. Then you call them different species.
Well, that could be a nightmare because you can have, some of these proteins have 27 phosphorylation sites.
Yeah.
You can have a confirmation change without actually any change in connectivity or.
No, I know. You would have to keep a separate species for each confirmation.
Yeah. That's
the
way.
That's a problem because you can have a large number of consequence. One enzyme can produce a whole bunch of different species in this scheme.
anything that would interact differently, if the two conformations interacted differently with the other constituents, then you'd have to treat the two conformations as separate species, and that's a lot of work, and I agree.
And my second question is, for making this a software package, one way to do it that probably might not be too smart, but you start with the most expensive metric and run it for a while, and if it doesn't finish, you have an expensive metric. So you don't get an evaluation of how well it works, but you do get an answer, and it's the best answer that you can get.
Okay, another, yes.
Is there any sort of like reactionary equation you can think of if you solve it just the ordinary differential equation, and then if you solve the given mass equation or stochastic algorithm? In both of the cases, if you have still many, many like number of the particles,
if they don't agree, let's do the simulation, the stochastic simulation algorithm, and the reaction rate equation. Let's say you do them both together. Now, if they both agree, then the lesson is don't use the stochastic simulation algorithm. Use the reaction rate equation. If they don't agree, and they don't agree significantly, like the successive traces of the stochastic simulation algorithm don't lie on top of each other as much as you'd like, then that's the signal that you need to use the stochastic simulation algorithm. Yes. Well, in that case, the Langevin equation, remember, is a higher order approximation to the stochastic simulation algorithm. You're at the stochastic simulation algorithm. If you take one approximation, you go to tau leaping. Now, another approximation on top of that takes you to the Langevin equation, and one more would take you to the reaction rate equation. But if it turns out that things are still kind of stochastic, but just a little bit, that's the time you should be using the Langevin equation. But if you see that the trajectories are really varying from each other, then even the Langevin equation is not going to be good enough. You have to back up further. Maybe the tau leaping, and maybe tau leaping is not even good enough. Maybe, you know, things are down low populations and really going around, maybe the best, you're best off sticking with the SSA. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I pretty much like your derivation of the chemical Langevin equation. I mean, it's pretty motivated, very transparent, but it has been discussed very extensively in the literature.
Yes.
Not his own extension and discussion with people. But could you comment on what the discussion was and given that your derivation is so straightforward? And so what was the debate actually?
Well, this was a contentious issue. I wrote a paper in the year 2000 in the Journal of Chemical Physics on this. And the last section of that paper talks about the various approaches to this problem. There have actually been three different chemical Langevin equations proposed. And the one that I came up is one of those three. And of course, it's the one I said, well, that's right. And the others were not quite so right. But it gets down into unpleasantnesses like the style of the person who was doing the research and how you approached it. It was a mess. There were all these contending equations and everybody was saying theirs is right, and some people were saying none of them were right. Van Kampen in particular, if you know his book, he made much of the fact that the noise in a chemical system like this, a jump Markov process, what I call a jump Markov process, is inherent, is internal. It's not externally added like you do to a Langevin equation. It was thought at the time that the only way you can get a Langevin equation is to start with a deterministic equation and just tack some noise onto it. And Van Kampen said that's not a good way to do, because the noise in a Langevin, in the chemical Langevin equation, whatever it is, ought to arise intrinsically from the inside. Well, this does. And this shows how it does. So I agree with Van Kampen on that. On the other hand, he had a system size expansion, which I think missed the mark. But that's just my opinion, and he's smarter than I am in many ways, and maybe I'm wrong. Yes?
And just what does well-stirred mean for small amounts of molecules, like 5 molecules? What does well-stirred mean?
It means that you really have no knowledge of where in the system the molecules are, and there's no reason to assume that, for example, that they're clustered in one corner or another. It's a random sampling. It's this: if the probability of finding one of those molecules in a certain volume is the ratio of that volume to the total volume, then the system is well stirred. But that's what I call, that's the definition of well stirred. It doesn't mean they have to lie on regular lattice points.
Yeah, in fact, you can have one molecule in a cell and still satisfy the well stirred assumption.
Yes.
It just means that it's diffusing about, and most of its collisions don't create a reaction. Which is actually, if you got one molecule, that's quite a good assumption. That it's mostly like the sigma 32 we talked about yesterday. There's either the free sigma 32 is either 0 or 1. And it's only going to have a reaction when it hits DNA K or RNA polymerase. And so most of the time, it's just going to bump into water. And so that creates a well stirred situation, even though there's only 0 or 1 molecule.
Yes?
So when other people, like biologists, use these simulations to model, for example, DNA interactions, polymerase DNA interactions, like Adam's model of phage lambda, does that ruin the well-based assumption? Because now it's on a DNA, and you know it's sitting there on the DNA, even though it's...
No, I see what you mean. I think the answer is no. To argue and prove it, I'd have to think a bit, but basically what happens when it gets on the DNA, then you kind of take it out of the system and you let it go do its thing as it runs down there. But the rest of the system, and you don't consider that reaction anymore, you consider that separately. You let it run its course, and I think you take it as a gamma random variable, a sum of Poissons and everything like that. But the rest of the system is well stirred, so what Adam did is right, I think. Okay.
If you take a reaction rate equation that don't have a simple stationary solution, like a fixed one, let's say the Lusso-Jabotinsky reaction, so it oscillates in time when it's a solid state.
Yes.
How does the SSA?
How does the SSA work on it?
My question is, did you compare actually?
Yes, I actually did. I did in the original paper I did back in 1977, which was published in the Journal of Chemical Physics. And I don't have any reprints of it anymore, but I did three oscillating systems, but two of them were limit cycles. One was the Brusselator, and the other was the Origonator. And the Origonator is the one that's the simplified version of the Belousov-Jabotinsky reaction. And what it turned up something interesting that I think was not known. As the thing goes about on its limit cycle, when you solve the deterministic reaction rate equations, you get a line that goes around in some space like that, and the system always stays on that. Now, as you would expect, when you do the stochastic simulation, it does fluctuations about those lines. But what's interesting is that in the Brusselator, for example, you can identify at least 6 stages along the trajectory where the fluctuations are of markedly different character and of different sizes. And on one of the stages, this is the fast stage, when one of them goes up and the other goes down, like, bang, and then it kind of goes on and bang. Well, the location of the bang and the size of the bang is much larger, it varies, fluctuates, much more than you have any reason to expect. And it's an example of noise on the microscopic scale being translated to the macroscopic scale, being amplified, and seeing this. When I first did it, I didn't know anything about these. I just plugged into the SSA. I wasn't a chemist, and I got these results. I showed them to a chemist, and he says, that's very interesting, because he says, we see fluctuations like that in the laboratory and looking at the Belousov-Jabotinsky reaction. We thought they're the result of experimental error, but we always thought they were large. Never got written up, because when I published this, a lot of chemists said it was no good. And basically, first they said it was wrong, and then after I fought that for a while, they said, well, we don't need it because we deal with Avogadro's number of molecules and we don't see the fluctuations. And I said, okay, I'll go on. And for 15 years, I did something else. But it's there. I mean, it cases like this show that where this reaction, the fluctuations are there. Okay, Linda.
Yeah,